persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
This is Stephen I. Engel, a businessman who lives on Long Island. This is William J. Vitale, Jr., former president of a Long Island school board. And this is Engel versus Vitale, a case that began here in the courthouse in Mineola, Long Island, and ended here in the Supreme Court of the United States. Subject of the dispute, a 22-word prayer recited each morning in the public schools of the Herrick School District.
Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence upon thee, and we beg thy blessings upon us, our parents, our teachers, and our country. Amen.
That is the way the prayer was recited until June 25, 1962, when a 6-1 decision of the United States Supreme Court declared the practice unconstitutional and a new storm broke over the Supreme Court. Both houses of Congress exploded.
You know, it's a terrible thing to say that you can't have prayer in the schools of this country. Why, the state is founded upon religion. And I ask you, sir, to think, isn't the number one, one of the number one objectives of atheistic communism, the destruction of the religious and spiritual life of this country?
I didn't go there to strike God down or to make an attack on religion. I didn't go there on behalf of a bunch of atheists. I went there on behalf of people that believed deeply in God and who wanted to worship God their way. And I wanted to make this very clear to the court, that I came there in the spirit of Jefferson and Madison, in the conviction that if the civil magistrate is kept out of this area, that the religious freedom of us all is that much more secure.
CBS reports the school prayer case. Here now is CBS News correspondent Eric Severi.
Good evening. In Storm Over the Supreme Court, Part 1, we examine the history of the High Court from John Marshall's day to Earl Warren. Tonight, the biography of a single decision, the Regent's Prayer case. Before the case was over, it filled these four massive volumes, more than 1,800 pages. But it all began with this single page, issued in 1951 by the New York Board of Regents, the state's highest educational body. This statement recommended that a 22-word prayer be offered at the beginning of each day of school. Some school districts ignored the recommendation. Others, including the Herrick School District on Long Island, complied.
Mrs. Mary A. Hart, a member of the Herrick School Board for the past 9 years, explains.
I picked the Regent's Prayer myself. When I made the motion in 1956 in July, it was seconded by Mr. Vitale, but it didn't pass. There was a 3-2 vote, so nothing happened that year. The next year, in July, I brought it up again, and there was no second, so there was no prayer in the school. The third year, in 1958, I brought it up again, and at that time, it was seconded by Mr. Saunders, a member of the board, and it carried by a majority.
President of the board at that time was William J. Vitale, Jr.
The teachers were to be instructed that this was not necessarily a compelling thing, that if a child, for some basic reason, chose to be excused, he or she would be excused. We did not anticipate, certainly at that time, some of the developments which later took place.
The first development took place here, even before the children began to pray. This is the home of Lawrence Roth, who had two children in the Herrick School.
My immediate reaction was that the state and the school board had no right to impose religion or prayers on the school children. My basic feeling was that if the state could tell us what to pray and when to pray and how to pray, that there was no stopping. Most of the neighbors were upset, as I was, some for different reasons, some because of what they considered to be the school board's high-handedness in doing this, and I felt that something had to be done about it, that it just couldn't stand the way it was. And so I called the offices of the New York Civil Liberties Union and spoke to Mr. George Rundquist.
He raised the question whether or not this was a matter that the Civil Liberties Union would be interested in, since it related to separation of church and state, a position that we have had for many years. I invited him to come over and talk with me. First of all, there was a question of whether or not he would be willing to be a plaintiff in an action in the courts to restrain the local school board from proceeding with this prayer. What we did was to provide him with an attorney.
The attorney was William J. Butler, and Lawrence Routh went to see him.
Before he even came to see me, I knew that there was a constitutional issue involved because I was familiar with the general situation in New York. I knew, for instance, that it was the first time in the history of the United States that a state had actually composed a prayer and then inserted this prayer in one of its compulsory institutions. That was enough for me, to, in my own mind, to arrive at my conclusion that this was probably an activity barred to the state under the First Amendment. I asked him how many people in the community were interested and what was the extent of his contact with these people, and he said that he didn't know for sure, but that if I were interested in the case, he would go back to the community and see who was interested and what their particular interests were.
In order to get as wide a cross-section of petitioners as possible, I inserted, at my expense, an ad in two of the local newspapers.
The ad announced a suit to challenge the legality of prayers in public schools. Interested taxpayers were asked to respond. About 50 did. But the number willing to go to court dropped eventually to 11.
And I looked over the 11, and we had to drop five or six of them because of the fact that they did not have children in the public school system. And therefore, we didn't want to represent anyone that wasn't actually being injured in this proceeding. So we settled on five, two of which were members of the Jewish faith, one which was a member of the Unitarian faith, one a member of the Ethical Cultural Union, and the last a non-believer.
These five became the petitioners in the case. The case in legal shorthand and in history will be known as Engel versus Vitale. Engel because his name came first alphabetically, Vitale because he was president of the school board. Attorney Butler proceeded with the case for the petitioners.
We call our process server, which is a private concern in New York which makes monies by the serving of legal papers. And we delivered this petition, together with five or six copies, to this process server and directed him to take them to Long Island and serve them on the members of the school board.
At my home one evening, the doorbell rang and there was a gentleman there who presented me as a president of the board with a petition by these taxpayers for a hearing before the Supreme Court, petitioning the court to enjoin the board from continuing this practice in our schools. After receiving the petition, of course, at our meeting next following, we spoke to our board attorney and turned the papers over to him.
The attorney for the school board was Bertram Dacre of the firm of Gunn, Nyer, and Dacre.
This, then, is my job as school attorney to prepare an adequate defense for any lawsuit which is brought against the Board of Education. And while this is not an action in the generally accepted sense, it is what is called a special proceeding under our jurisprudence in this state. What we prepared was an answer.
At that point, both legally and as an actual fact, the issues were joined. We had made affirmative allegations. They had denied these allegations. Therefore, we had an issue, whether or not we were right or whether or not they were right.
The battle joined. A third party entered the case. In legal terms, they are called the intervenors.
It was not long after that, and before we got to argument in Mineola Supreme Court, that a group of 15 parents interested in seeing that the prayer continue and perhaps anticipating that the litigation might run for several years and board members might change and school attorneys might change. And they wanted to see this prayer continued within this school district. Sought leave of the court to intervene as parties respondent and were granted such leave.
The case of Engel versus Vitale was heard on February 24th, 1959, in the Nassau County Courthouse, Long Island, before the Supreme Court of the State of New York. Though it bears that name, this court is not really supreme. There are two higher state courts that hear appeals.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons lawfully appearing before this special term of the Supreme Court of the State of New York for the County of Nassau, give attendance, draw near, and ye shall be heard. The Honorable Justice Meyer presiding. Give your attention to the motion calendar. Engel against Vitale.
The justice who heard the case before an overflowing courtroom was Bernard S. Meyer. And after some preliminary legal skirmishes, the three attorneys proceeded with their arguments. Here, filmed in a moot courtroom, is the substance of those arguments. Mr. Butler, for the petitioners.
May the court please. My adversaries are attempting to place me and my clients as the leaders of godlessness in our society. They point to us as atheists. They point to us as non-believers. They point to us as materialists and secularists. Nothing could be further from the truth. We come before this court representing four individuals with deep religious convictions. It is true that one of our clients is a non-believer. But we come here in the spirit of Madison and Jefferson, in the conviction, the deep conviction, that the religious liberty not only of our clients, but of all Americans, lies in the principle of law set forth in the First Amendment to the Constitution, which says that Congress shall make no law respecting the anestablishment of religion or preventing the free exercise thereof, and is made applicable to the states of this Union by the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. And we say further that our case is squarely within the McCollum case. McCollum, as you know, is a case involving the release time in the public schools of Illinois, where children of that school were allowed to leave their homeroom classes and go to other rooms within the school for the purpose of hearing their own religious leaders instruct them in their respective faiths. The Supreme Court, in an 8-1 decision, held that this was an unconstitutional activity on the part of the state. Now, insofar as the McCollum case is concerned, our case is even stronger. Not only in our case is there a use of the public school for religious purposes or for religious exercises, not only in our case is the teacher involved in excusing the child to go to a religious exercise, not only in our case does it involve a religious activity during school hours, and not only in our case is the purpose to teach religion or to teach a religious exercise. But even further, our case says that here the child must stay in the classroom unless there's an affirmative act on the part of his parents to excuse him. We say, of course, that there is a compulsion here, that there was coercion, that the little child will not leave the school, that he will stay in the room and he'll be subjected to the prayer. Because as Mr. Justice Frankfurter said in McCollum, nonconformity is not an outstanding characteristic of little children. In the end, this type of activity on the part of the state, there spells the end of religious liberty, because sooner or later, government will prefer one religious belief over another religious belief, and then in the end, the minority, or the ones not in power, will lose their religious liberty.
Mr. Dacre, attorney for the school board, presented his argument next.
May it please the court. I think at this point I should emphasize before the court the wording of the First Amendment, because sometimes it is passed over very easily by referring to it as something which prohibits the establishment of religion. These are not the words which appear in the First Amendment to the Constitution, but those words read exactly, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. An establishment of religion. The intention at that time was to prevent the establishment of a state church or a national church. It was not in any way to interfere with the religious freedoms of all of our people, because there is embedded in the history of this country and in the traditions of this country a very deep-seated spiritual heritage to which this generation is heir. I think perhaps one of the most striking examples of prayer in public is before our United States Supreme Court itself, where the crier comes out from the side and intones the words, "God save the United States and this honorable court." We've had references made to Justice Frankfurter's opinion about nonconformity and embarrassment, that there is no protection here for a child who asks or whose parents ask that he be excused from participating in these opening exercises. We had the same type of argument advanced, perhaps, in the West Virginia against Barnett case, which involved a child of Jehovah's Witnesses who said, "I cannot join in the pledge to the flag because this constitutes a violation of my religious concept of the first commandment. This is a matter of idolatry, of worship of a sort, and I will refuse to join in that." And when this case got before the same United States Supreme Court, the court said, "We will not require this child to join in this pledge to the flag where it is contrary to her religious convictions, but we will not strike it out for everyone else." I think the parallel is striking between that situation and what we have in our present case. Do not strike out this prayer for everyone else any more than the Supreme Court struck out the pledge of the flag for everyone else, because Jehovah's Witnesses say we cannot salute the flag. We urge this court to sustain the position taken by the Respondent Board of Education.
Porter R. Chandler, a New York attorney.
I represent the intervenor parents who have come into this case on the side of the school board. Mr. Dacre has pointed out that there is not one iota of compulsion in this situation. The coercion, the infringement of the free exercise of religious liberty, I submit, is all on the other side. Because what Mr. Butler's clients are asking this court to do is to say that because Mr. Butler's clients object to having their children say this small, 23-word, innocuous prayer, therefore, no one else is to be allowed to say it. Mr. Butler, in his opening remarks, apparently does not object to the fact that this is a religious nation. He apparently does not object to incidental references to God, provided that they are all kept out of the schools. It's all right for soldiers and sailors and congressmen and people in prison to have chaplains provided for them by the government. It's all wrong for a child to have any mention of God put before him within the walls of a public school. And I should like to leave this thought: whose rights and whose civil liberties are really here involved? The rights of these petitioners who claim no damage, no injury, no compulsion, and no coercion to themselves? Or the rights of the vast majority of parents in this and other districts who ask only that by the voluntary recital of this prayer, their children be allowed to participate in what they regard as the basic spiritual heritage of this nation?
Mr. Butler, in rebuttal.
In other words, to rephrase Mr. Chandler's remarks, does the majority have the right to use state institutions to impose upon a minority the religious conviction of the majority? My adversaries claim that we are a religious nation, that we are a Christian nation. I want the court to know that I don't disagree with these premises, nor do I contend that the teaching about religion has to come out of the public school system of the United States. Nor do I contend that in any way incidental mentions of God, whether in ceremonial utterances or not, have to be removed from the public school system of the United States. What I do say, however, is that the teaching of religion, the insertion of a religious ritual, the state taking over who a man should pray to, how he should pray, the manner in which he should pray, has been left to the people. This is what I want to keep sacrosanct in our society. This is the liberty that I want to defend. And in the long run, if we can maintain the wall of separation of church and state at a high level, there is the ultimate protection for religious freedom. What we need more than anything else is people who not only believe in, but who are not afraid of freedom.
The argument's over, court was adjourned, and at this point, CBS reports, had some questions to ask of our own distinguished legal consultant, Paul Freund, professor of constitutional law at the Harvard Law School. Professor Freund, was there any way at this point in time for anybody to know that this case would eventually become a cause célèbre?
Hardly, I should say. There were cases all around the country, dozens of cases, funneling their way up through state courts, which might conceivably have reached the Supreme Court first. In other words, what counsel had at this stage was more like a lottery ticket than a reserved seat for the Supreme Court in Washington.
When the decision in Engle versus Vitale was handed down by Justice Bernard S. Meyer on August 24, 1959, 7 months after the original hearing, it ran to 67 pages. Professor Freund.
Justice Meyer, in a lengthy, learned, and thoughtful opinion, ruled this, in brief, that the Establishment Clause of the Constitution does not prohibit the non-compulsory saying of the Regent's Prayer in the public schools, but that the Free Exercise Clause requires that respondent board take affirmative steps to protect the rights of those who, for whatever reason, choose not to participate. The school board and the intervenors had won their case. Justice Meyer signed an order allowing the exercise to continue in the schools, but he insisted on an additional provision for the protection of the minority who might not want to join in the prayer.
Well, it seems strange to me that a judge would render a decision saying, in effect, at least it seemed to me, he was saying that this is legal, but if you do so-and-so, it's going to be even more legal.
The next step was an appeal to the first appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, which is called our appellate division.
That next step was less than 25 miles, but more than 7 months away. On March 31st, 1960, more than a year after the original hearing, arguments were heard in this Brooklyn courthouse. Almost 7 months after that, the five judges handed down their decision. Professor Freund.
In the appellate division, the court rendered a per curiam decision, that is to say, a brief, unsigned memorandum for the court, in which the court said this: we agree with the views expressed in the opinion of the learned justice at special term. That means simply that the petitioners had lost again. And because the opinion of the appellate division was unanimous, under New York practice, the petitioners, if they wanted to appeal, would have to get the permission of the very court itself, which had decided against them, or the permission of the Court of Appeals, the highest court of the state.
You might well feel that with five justices in the appellate division and one in the Nassau Supreme Court deciding in your favor, it's now 6-0, that they might stop there.
We chose to make our motion in the Court of Appeals, alleging in effect that we had a serious constitutional issue. It was opposed by the other side on the ground that there was not the issue that we said existed, and that it was a simple question of a law which had been decided by the lower court, and there was no need for further appellate review. The Court of Appeals rejected this argument and did allow us to come to it.
Engle versus Vitale now moved 150 miles up the Hudson River to the state capitol at Albany. There, the highest court of the state sits. Arguments were held on May 25th, 1961. The decision came down in July. Professor Freund.
in the highest court of the state, the Court of Appeals, the bench for the first time in this case was divided. The majority opinion was written by Chief Judge Desmond, who said this: saying this simple prayer may be, according to the broadest possible dictionary definition, an act of religion. But when the Founding Fathers prohibited an establishment of religion, they were referring to official adoption of or favor to one or more sects. On the other hand, the dissenters, in an opinion by Judge Dye, with which Judge Fuld concurred, said this: in sponsoring a religious program, the state enters a field which it has been thought best to leave to the church alone. However salutary the underlying purpose of the requirement may be, it nonetheless gives to the state a direct supervision and influence that overstep the line marking the division between church and state and cannot help but lead to a gradual erosion of the mighty bulwark erected by the First Amendment.
So our box score at that point was that we had 11 judges who had decided in our favor as against two who felt otherwise.
It was at this level that I began to really take hope. I felt that we had gotten some measure of recognition in the courts, and that if we could only get to the Supreme Court, that I felt then that the Supreme Court would rule for us.
The Supreme Court decided to hear the case, which in effect meant that at least four justices of that court decided that they wanted to hear the case. I received a telegram from the clerk of the Supreme Court of the United States, which simply said, petition for certiorari in the matter of Engle versus Vitale, granted by the Supreme Court of the United States.
Professor Freund, the Supreme Court decided to take this particular case. Now, how do they make such a decision? To take a case like this and not a lot of other cases?
They took it, presumably, because it raised an important issue of constitutional law which had not been decided but ought to be decided. The court might have dismissed the case on the ground that the petitioners did not have a sufficient interest. As taxpayers, their financial burden was not increased. As parents, they were not obliged to let their children take part in the ceremony. There were really two legal maxims in conflict here. One, in the Latin form, de minimis non curat lex, which means the law does not take account of trifles. On the other hand, obsta principiis, withstand beginnings, beware the entering wedge. One can say that the court preferred the second maxim, in this case, beware the entering wedge.
So the Supreme Court of the United States agreed to take the case.
April 3rd, 1962, 3 years and 7 months after the first attorney had been retained.
God save the United States and this honorable court.
The same three lawyers who argued the case in Mineola, in Brooklyn, and in Albany now stood before the highest court in the land. Even for the big court, Engle versus Vitale was a big one. Certainly it was for Mr. Dacre.
I look forward with anticipation to arguing Engle against Vitale. I came away from the court with the feeling of an attorney who finally gets to argue a case before this august body. As you stand up, you find that you suddenly are perhaps the most lonesome person in the world. Behind you are anywhere from 300 to 400 people seated at chairs which don't squeak. The floors are covered with a heavy carpeting, so there is no sound. The person in the farthest corner of the room away from you can hear your every breath. And you stand there as though you were on a deserted island, all alone, wondering perhaps, have you prepared for everything that might be asked of you? And you realize full well that if they ask you a question and you don't know the answer, there's no one in that courtroom to help you. You can't lean over to your neighbor or your associate and ask a question. You must come up with an answer.
Of course, when one prepares a case before the Supreme Court of the United States, he very rarely takes into consideration the extent of the questioning. Each side was allowed 1 hour to argue its case. I argued for an hour, and both my adversaries had a half hour each. At the beginning of the argument, I approached the lectern, and there was a light which is used to signal the attorneys when they're nearing the close of the time allowed them for argument. If you prepare your case for 1 hour and you get a barrage of questioning for 30 or 40 minutes, then your whole preparation for the case is in disarray. In a way, that's what happened in our case. I had prepared myself for a very thorough argument lasting for almost an hour, but it was only a few minutes after I got into the argument that after I had recited the prayer itself, that Mr. Justin Holland said, "What's wrong with that, Mr. Butler?" I told him that as far as I was concerned, and as far as three of the five of my clients were concerned, that there was nothing wrong with it. That our position wasn't in opposition to prayer itself. It was in opposition to the state determining what kind of prayers American people should say.
Chief Justice Warren asked another question. Is it not a religious practice to say a prayer? And my answer was, certainly there is such a thing as a supplication to God, and any supplication or prayer is a religious practice, just as the court's prayer is a religious practice. But the question before the court is not, is a religious practice banned, but is what is done such as to amount to an establishment of religion, an establishment of a national or a state church?
Shortly afterwards in the argument, Mr. Justice Frankfurter asked whether I rejected the concept that our educational system must be entirely secular. I explained, as nearly as I can recall, that our whole national heritage was both secular and religious, and that it was impossible to separate out the one from the other at every stage, and that in that sense I would reject the principle that our public school education of necessity has to be secular in the sense contended for by my opponents.
When you reach this last court, this court of last resort for the entire country, you then realize fully the great document that our Constitution is in providing for the opportunity for individuals to come before the court with respect to their rights, and the opportunity afforded attorneys to champion those rights. Then you walk away from the court when you are finished with the feeling that you have indeed, for one day, been a part of history.
Opinion day in the case of Engel versus Vitale was Monday, June 25th, 1962. Mark Van Doren, who read from the landmark decisions of the Supreme Court in our first program, reads from the majority opinion of Justice Hugo Black.
It has been argued that to apply the Constitution in such a way as to prohibit state laws respecting an establishment of religious services in public schools is to indicate a hostility toward religion or toward prayer. Nothing, of course, could be more wrong. The framers of the Bill of Rights knew that the First Amendment, which tried to put an end to governmental control of religion and of prayer, was not written to destroy either. They knew rather that it was written to quiet, well-justified fears, which nearly all of them felt, arising out of an awareness that governments of the past had shackled men's tongues to make them speak only the religious thoughts that government wanted them to speak, and to pray only to the God that government wanted them to pray to. It is neither sacrilegious nor anti-religious to say that each separate government in this country should stay out of the business of writing or sanctioning official prayers and leave that purely religious function to the people themselves and to those the people choose to look to for religious guidance.
That's the majority opinion of five men, with Justice Douglas agreeing in somewhat different language. Wasn't there a dissent?
There was, by Mr. Justice Stewart. And he put the case for the validity of the school prayer exercise in these words, in part. With all respect, I think the court has misapplied a great constitutional principle. I cannot see how an official religion is established by letting those who want to say a prayer say it. On the contrary, I think that to deny the wish of these school children to join in reciting this prayer is to deny them the opportunity of sharing in the spiritual heritage of our nation.
Lawrence Roth, who won the case, said this.
And the first message came to me at work in a telephone call. I admit that I was stunned. What started out as a feeling within us grew eventually to a test and a demonstration, let's say, of what I consider to be really the essence of the American way of doing things. The right of the citizen to petition his government for a redress of what he considers to be a wrongdoing. I can't emphasize how strong I feel about that, because I feel that if we lose that, we have lost everything.
The man who lost the case, Mr. Vitale, said this.
The court has made its decision, and as a good citizen, more so as an attorney, I must respect that decision. This does not necessarily mean that I agree with that decision.
Mrs. Hart, whose motion put the prayer into the Herrick schools in the first place, said this.
I felt that inasmuch as the Supreme Court had decided we couldn't have it in the schools, we would have to abide by their decision. At that time, I was president of the board and sitting in this chair right here. And we waited for the Commissioner of Education of New York State to send down what they thought what we should do. And they suggested a moment of silence, and that's what we're doing now.
While the school board was adjusting to the Supreme Court's decision, the national reaction was anything but calm. The headlines shouted, confusion, defiance, protest.
They put the Negroes in the schools, now they put God out of the school.
One minister posted on his announcement board, congratulations, Khrushchev, God help America. Congressman Frank Becker of Long Island thundered,
this was not the first tragic decision of the Supreme Court, but I would say it was the most tragic decision in the history of the United States.
Senator Herman Talmadge of Georgia said,
the Supreme Court decision has dealt a blow to all believers in a supreme being and has given aid to the disciples and followers of atheism by whatever name they see fit to call themselves.
Cardinal Spellman of the Archdiocese of New York said that the ruling shocked and frightened him. And in San Francisco, Episcopal Bishop James A. Pike joined the protest.
When the Supreme Court in Engle against Vitale ruled out the New York School of Prayer, I said at the time that I felt the court had deconsecrated the nation.
But not everyone denounced the court's decision. The President of the United States said this.
It is important for us, if we're going to maintain our constitutional principle, that we support Supreme Court decisions, even when we may not agree with them. In addition, we have in this case a very easy remedy, and that is to pray ourselves.
The Reverend Dr. C. Emanuel Carlson, Director of the Baptist Joint Committee on Public Affairs.
20 million Baptists in all parts of our land appreciate the part that the Supreme Court has played in protecting our freedom of religion. Anyone who stops to think through the meaning of prayer and to find in it the relationship of a person to his God will automatically conclude that this is something that lies beyond the scope of government.
Senator Philip A. Hart of Michigan.
I'm a Catholic, and I hope a devout one. But I think the public school classroom is no place for me to try and impose my word formula for prayer on children who don't share it. And for that very reason, I don't want my children in a public school classroom to be exposed to someone else's religion or formula. So that I think the Supreme Court decision was right and proper.
National confusion over what the court's decision means and does not mean continues. We asked Professor Freund if the decision meant that all references to God had to be removed from the public schools.
Certainly not, because you will find, buried perhaps in footnote 21 of the majority opinion, an explicit statement that, of course, nothing in this opinion is meant to outlaw ceremonial or patriotic observances with allusions to a supreme being, or the singing of a national anthem with references to the deity. And so far as I can see from the opinion, religion itself may be a subject of study.
Professor Freund, what about the press handling of this religious case in the schools? Associate Justice Clark said he thought it was rather badly presented.
Justice Clark evidently spoke under great provocation. I think the immediate reporting of the decision by the news services was not inaccurate or a distortion. But given the pressure of time and the limitations of space of the wire services and the newscasting, I think the real problem is the interpretation of the opinions in editorial comment and in the publicized comment of public figures. Here it seems to me that if a simple question were asked to would-be commentators or editorial writers, namely, have you read the full text of all the opinions in the case, this would be a safeguard against hasty and ill-informed and often inflammatory comment. This is too explosive an issue to be left lying around for careless and heavy-handed treatment.
But 9 months after the decision, opinion, even among scholars who revere the court, is still divided. The heads of two of our great law schools differ. Dean Irwin N. Griswold of Harvard.
It seems to me unfortunate that the New York school prayer case ever came before the Supreme Court of the United States for decision, and that it was decided there one way or the other. There is, it seems to me, in this sort of problem in the Supreme Court, an unfortunate absolutist point of view, a point of view that the First Amendment, which provides that Congress shall pass no law respecting an establishment of religion, means, as Justice Black has said, that no law means no law, and therefore there can be no law of any sort in this area. To me, there are many words in the First Amendment, and not merely no law, but also establishment of religion and free exercise thereof. And I find it difficult to see how what was done in New York with respect to the school prayer there can appropriately be regarded as an establishment of religion. I also find it somewhat difficult to see why this was not a preventing of the people of New York from carrying on their free exercise of religion if in their own individual communities they felt that this simple prayer was an appropriate way to start off the school day, was an appropriate element in their overall picture of education.
The dean of the Yale Law School, Eugene V. Rostow, differs.
Well, I'm reluctant to disagree with Dean Griswold, for whom I have great respect, but in this instance, I must do so. I think the court was right to take the Engel case and right in the way it disposed of it. After all, the pilgrims and many other people came to this country in order to escape religion imposed upon them or pressed upon them by the state. The memory of their principles has been revived for us in recent years by the political activity of religious groups in many areas of our national life, in education, in censorship, and elsewhere. In that perspective, the court's action in the Engel case is a call for wise forbearance on our part, call to all of us to avoid a controversy which is so deep in our constitutional tradition and which has added nothing but misery both to ancient and to modern history. The case came to the Supreme Court, as cases normally do. Ever since the war, there's been a bubbling up around the country of issues concerning religion in the public schools. Some of those controversies have come into the lower courts, both state and federal. They've been pressed. The Supreme Court waited, as it normally does, to see whether the controversy was really acute enough to require its intervention. The cases showed no signs of abating. The conflict within our public life continued and indeed grew more intense. So finally, in this and a few similar cases, the Supreme Court has intervened, has accepted jurisdiction, and has begun the long, complex, and difficult process of opening up and organizing a new field of law.
Professor Freund, suppose the national will, expressed how it may be, is really against this court opinion. How can it be overturned?
The Supreme Court is not ultimately the last word, because there's always the process of constitutional amendment. 2/3 of Congress and 3/4 of the states could undo this decision. But before undoing it, they would, unlike some commentators who shoot off the intellectual hip, as it were, they would be forced to give sober, hard, continuous thought to whether they really mean to alter the guarantees of the First Amendment in this way.
Senator Eastland's Judiciary Committee has already conducted hearings on some proposals for constitutional amendments.
Yes, I have my own amendment. Now, I don't know whether it's one the committee will report out or not. Section 1 of my amendment provides this: nothing in this Constitution shall prohibit the offering of prayers or the reading of the Bible as part of the program of any public school or other public place in the United States. We've got to amend the Constitution of the United States to restate the First Amendment to the Constitution to preserve the real intent of that amendment.
Bishop Pike and others who favored amending the Constitution are now inclined to wait for decisions in two cases argued before the court 2 weeks ago.
I shall read Psalm 111. Praise the Lord.
These cases, soon to be decided by the Supreme Court and to be reported on a future CBS report, involve the Lord's Prayer and Bible reading in Baltimore schools and in the public schools of Abington Township, Pennsylvania, shown here.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those who practice it. His praise endures forever. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
The
power,
the
glory, forever and ever.
Amen. Professor Freund, has there been anything like this ever before in our history on this issue?
I think we often forget that this issue can be a highly explosive one. Indeed, in our own country, more than 100 years ago, it eventuated in violence, in street fighting, in church burning. When, for example, in Philadelphia, the Protestant King James Version of the Bible was read in the public schools, and a group of Catholics bitterly objected, urging that the Douay Version be read. And in retaliation, Catholics were set upon, and their churches were put to flame.
So we're apt to live with this question in an excited form for quite a while, then.
I should suppose so, as, of course, we've lived with it for more than a century. Prior to that, these were political issues. These were issues that often were settled by violence or sought to be settled by violence. Now we look to the court. The court is a sort of escape valve, maybe a scapegoat. It's part of the social function of courts to take on themselves some of the aggressions that will otherwise find their expression in social life. And we can't have it both ways. If we want the court to accept this burden, if we want to avoid making this a political issue or an issue of violence, then we must recognize that the court is doing what we expect it to do, and we must withhold our abuse.
We've set this court up as a kind of a lightning rod.
Yes, and sometimes the lightning rod is blamed for the lightning.
From tonight, CBS reports Biography of a Bookie Joint. Originally televised 14 months ago, this report has had impact in Boston and throughout the nation. It will be seen in Boston next week for the first time. CBS reports acknowledges the cooperation of the Fordham Law School, in whose moot courtroom the substance of the attorney's arguments in the first hearing in Engel versus Vitale were filmed for this report. CBS reports Storm Over the Supreme Court Part 2 was filmed and edited by the staff of CBS reports under the supervision and control of CBS News.